0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Colm O'Mungain here. Text us on 51551. Joe at rte.ie for your emails. WhatsApp 0871843709. Well, yesterday we opened the programme with Angelina, a working age mother who told us that every day she fears dying. And this is because her son, Edward, who's autistic and has high support needs, he's, as I say, in his 30s, and like many other mothers who have children of this age who require support, she is worried about what will happen after she's gone. She said, Edward regularly asks her, will you always be here to look after me, mommy? And she cannot give him that answer. But what she does want in terms of an answer for her is a residential place that she knows Edward will be looked after in, where he has access to family members and the network he's been used to, and that he could transition into that setting before Angelina dies. She said she felt isolated and alone. And as we saw from the number of calls and contacts we got throughout yesterday and indeed into today, that she's far from that. What's the plan, she wants to know? When is that transition going to happen? There were 500 applicants for residential places in her area last year and only 4 were provided. So clearly the need is high, but the provision is low. And the excuses a lot of parents are getting from the HSE is that resources have to be managed and they may not fit the criteria for the residential places that are being provided. There are hundreds more applicants across the country. Angelina's area, as I say, only 500 applicants in her area alone, and there are hundreds more across the country. Parents whose children are in their 30s and they are of an age where they are beginning to consider their own mortality and what would happen after that. And there's a genuine fear, not for their own lives, but who will look after their children, what setting they'll be in, and what access they will have to visitors and family and that afterwards. We were inundated with parents getting in touch. And Mary O'Donnell, you heard yesterday what Angelina had to say. You could relate to that.
Absolutely. I suppose the difference between myself and Angelina is that I'm in my second year of retirement now. I've stopped working, and of course I've got more time to think about what's happening, even though from the day and hour a child with a disability comes into your life, the one fear is losing your life and that child being left in limbo. Who is going to look after him? Not everybody, I'd like to point out here, not everybody has family who are willing or able to look after your child if something happens. You know, on a day-to-day basis, we're lucky we have some family members who accept unconditionally Barry's disability, if you like, and also wonderful friends and fantastic neighbours. But at the end of the day, it's his Barry's two brothers that I worry about as well. I don't want to leave an issue for them. They have their lives. They're working. They can't give up their work in order to look after Barry. He attends St. Michael's House. Absolutely fantastic service from St. Michael's House. He attends a day unit there, and we are so lucky to have it. And I know that because there are some people out there, some adult children out there, who have nothing. But I feel the main issue is the funding. We've been hearing, you know, in recent weeks about the excess funds that are available.
10 billion of a surplus this year, a projected 16 billion for next year, and 13 billion in an escrow account due to the Apple tax case.
Yes. Well, in September, 100 million of a boost was given to disability services. Now, it sounds like a lot of money, but that's over a few different sectors. 100 million is needed to go into respite care, another 100 million into residential care, another 100 million into day services. You know, it's very difficult for units like St. Michael's House, for example, to get staff and to keep staff. Why we have to ask the question, why is that? I would like to say that in terms of God, I'm losing the run
of myself.
You're
fine.
Here.
Tell us about your son.
Finance.
Yeah, go on. Sorry.
Okay, in terms of finance and what different areas are given, we're talking about children who cannot look out for themselves, who cannot talk for themselves, and who will never be able to, and will not understand when the parents disappear off the face of the earth. These children need to be helped in the transition, as Angelina said, in a transition to their new home. And it is the fear of every parent that that won't happen. God forbid something happened, my husband and myself. I have no idea what would happen, my son. No idea. But anyway, you asked me there about my own son. He's 36. He has a profound learning disability and autism. And as I said, he attends a wonderful day unit within St. Michael's House.
And what are his needs then when he comes home after that day service?
Well, he's home at about 2:30, 3:00. So he needs to be entertained. He's not one for, he loves rugby, he loves country music, and he likes girls. So he needs to be entertained. You know, he's brought to the park for a walk. My husband is wonderful at walking him for a couple of hours. He comes home. If he has nothing to do, he'll say, "Bed, mummy," because he's bored. Those things are minor compared to what I'm talking, not only for Barry, but for all those people out there who have massive challenges, huge challenges. And we're lucky in that Barry sleeps at night. There are people out there and they're driving around in their cars at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. We're driving around in the car all day if he's off, you know, at the weekend, Saturdays, Sundays, bank holiday, Monday.
Now how do you cater for all of those, you know, all of the things you say he's interested in, the rugby, the girls, the country music?
Well, obviously he has his earphones and he loves listening to his music. He likes going to concerts, the rugby, his dad would bring him to matches at the weekend. But they only take up a part of the time. He's not going to sit and listen to his country music for 6 hours in a row. In terms of the girls, he just likes to see his son's girlfriends coming into the house and that, you know. And he loves the girls who work with him in his unit. But my main point, I suppose I'd like to ask the minister and her team, does anyone actually visit the units that are looking after these adult children? Have they ever visited the homes of people who have massive challenges to see exactly what they are? Because I think if they did, it would give them a new perspective and give them more of an understanding of what needs to be done. You know, as I said, 100 million of a boost in September, it goes nowhere.
Well, that is the response that's often given, that all disability services, put collectively, residential, adult day programs, personal home assistance, all of these other things come to a total of 2 billion, just slightly over 2 billion. And the response is that, you know, spending on disability services is already high. That's frequently the response that's given. What do you say to that?
I say, while it may seem to be high in terms of need, it's not high enough. It most certainly isn't high enough. Other industries get boosts, but they're not industries that are in such dire need.
And what insight do you think people would get in coming into a home? In your own case, you know, you talk about, as you say, he sleeps at night. You know, he brings great joy into the lives of yourself and your husband.
Does.
And I'm sure many other parents would say the same thing. But just in terms of the requirement for, as you enter, you know, later years or after you're gone, what would the minister see if she went into your house?
Okay, well, I don't want to paint him as a saint, because he is no saint. Obviously, on top of all of that, he has huge challenges as well. What would she see, or what would one of her team see when they come in? Well, they would see that we don't sit for a meal, for example, that you don't sit for half an hour and have a meal together, because he's always in the fridge, or he's stopped looking for more, or he is somewhere where he needs attention. you know, it's a 24-hour thing. Apart from the sleeping at night, he does sleep at night, but you have to be on alert. And I do sleep very lightly because I am on alert waiting for him to get up. But and he doesn't do that too often. But
and do yourself and your husband get away, you know, on a holiday? Do you get a break from what sounds like a pretty active routine?
Yeah, we have been lucky enough in that we have had we had a break last year and we got away. But you know, we're depending on family, we're depending on friends, we're depending on others, and I suppose, you know, for us, it's not the now, it's not the here and now, it's the future that is the worry.
And when did you start with that feeling? You said at the outset, you know, that did it start when you realised that he was autistic? Was that it?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. But you see, he has a profound learning disability as well. So he doesn't understand. He's a 2-year-old distaff in a 36-year-old body. You know, you worry immediately. You know, I'd say anyone who knows that the child yet to be born is going to have a disability, they would start worrying then while the child was in the womb. Oh, there's no doubt about that. You worry from the get-go. What is going to happen when we're not here? And, you know, I can't stress that enough. And as we get
How did
older,
that change I'm, you as a person? Because most people don't have that when they wake up every day. They don't worry about who will take up their responsibilities after they die. So how much of a difference was that, even in the way you looked at life?
Huge. Absolutely huge. Our lives are different, and I'm sure every parent would agree. Our lives are completely different to those people who don't have a disability within the family. And of course, when you do have a child with a disability, you become a family with a disability. But the level of stress is huge. The worry, always looking over your shoulder, always wondering where he is, always wondering what he's at within the same house. When you go out, making sure you have hold of him. It is, I suppose, we do notice that if we're lucky enough to get a respite for a couple of days, the difference, and I feel quite disloyal to Barry saying this, but the difference is huge, you know, to what life is like when he's not here. And we absolutely adore him. We adore him. And I wouldn't be without him. But the difference between having a child with an intellectual disability, stroke autism, and not within the home is huge.
And you say that, you know, you adore him, you have great love for him, he brings joy into your life, and there are the challenges there. Is it difficult to advocate for yourselves as a family based on the challenges you face, because you always feel that you're not disrespecting him? You always feel, or you feel reluctant to say this, because implicitly people might read that as disrespect for him, or in some way giving out about him.
Yeah. And that's a very good point. Whatever way you turn, there's guilt. You know, for feeling relaxed when he's not here, you feel guilty. For looking for a service for him, saying, well, and you have to present the worst case scenario in order to get anything. You know, that's another thing that I'm sure parents would agree with. You have to present, I suppose, the worst side of the child in order to get someone to listen to you. And again, you have guilt in doing that. You know.
So what kind of a plan do you want to see? I mean, what would lift some of what you're dealing with off your shoulders? If you could map out the plan for Barry and for your family, because it's not just for him, it's for all of you, what would that plan look like?
Right. The dream would be for someone to call me and say, great news, we have a place for Barry. We're going to start that transition whenever, in 2025, 2026, 2027, whatever. And we are here to help him through that. His brothers are here because I know that his brothers will look after him as well when he is in residential care. But they would not be here to take on that task when they work themselves. They're not home at 2:30 or 3 o'clock. But that is the dream, and it shouldn't be a dream. You know, it should just be happening.
And presumably, I mean, you know what makes him tick. You know what his likes and dislikes are. If there was a transitional period, are you saying that you would have time to liaise with his new caregivers and introduce them to the different things he likes and dislikes, that it would help them and it would help you?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, thank you for bringing that up, because that is hugely important. You know, for a child to go into a new setting and for his carers not to understand him or know him is unthinkable. So it's very important that parents are around, and if they can't be, well, siblings, if there are any, or someone who knows him really well, to talk about his likes and dislikes and the challenges he may have at different times. That's a huge issue. And why this needs to be put in place for people who are going to transition from home into their forever home as they themselves go into old age, if you like, or get older. The years pass very quickly, and as we get older, I'm 69, my husband is 72, as we get older, the problem gets bigger. The worry and the stress gets bigger.
And your capacity to deal with it. I mean, you know, do you find do you find it tougher to deal with those considerations as
the
clock ticks down?
You know, we all, exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, we all come up against health issues as we get older. And they're exacerbated by stress, by worry.
Have you had that yourself?
Yes, we have. We have. I don't know. I have to just keep repeating and talking to the politicians out there. Is there somebody, is there a number of politicians who can stand up and be counted and say, this is not good enough? You know, a boost of 100 million into what I feel is a tsunami coming down the road for the number of people throughout the country. Yeah, for the number of people throughout the country. I'm sure you've seen it with the calls you're getting. The number of people throughout the country, number one, the ones who aren't getting any service, the ones who are getting a bit of a service. We're lucky we live in the capital.
Well, the figures from the HSE are there 1,205 applications for residential places in 2022, and an estimated cost of 149,000 per residential place. So that totals up at 180 million would be to clear the current backlog of applications. That's just a rough calculation based on their own estimate for what it would cost, plus the number of applications that were there last year. So, yeah, I mean, hundreds of people.
Yes, and 180 million out of the billions excess they have at the moment. Somebody needs to take the bull by the horns and say enough is enough. We need, I mean, societies are judged on how they treat the vulnerable, you know, and that's down to governments. And I feel successive governments have failed the vulnerable, whether it be the elderly, whether it be disability services, you know, something has to be done before, as I said, there's a tsunami of, well, first of all, there's going to be a tsunami of stress, of illness, you know, and this reaches further than residential care or respite care. You know, we're talking about the health service as well. We're talking about hospitals who have to deal with these parents who are becoming ill because of what they're dealing with and because of their situation. The answer is money. The answer is funding. And I know there are cries for funding for all sorts of reasons out there. But these are people who cannot speak for themselves. They cannot look out for themselves. They cannot mind themselves. They need 24-hour care. You know, how much worse has it to be before someone decides we need to do something here?
Claire Hendrick, you've been listening to Mary O'Donnell there talking about Barry. Oh. Tell us about Leah.
Well, I identify with her story so much. Leah is, first and foremost, a beautiful young lady, age 23, who happens to have an intellectual disability. And what she really wants, we discuss it all the time, she wants a life like you and I, like anybody out there. And in order for that to happen, she needs the right support systems put in place. The state know about our adult children. We didn't come in from the sky. We've been here from the day that we were born. And so they know about us. The whole system, I feel, is totally dysfunctional. No one is joining the dots. Different departments are working in different areas. We know the families. My daughter attends a service in St. John of God's, Dublin South East. There are 137 people on our crisis housing list. Now, crisis, like it's, I don't know what people have to do. I want to thank you for giving us the platform to discuss this, and I hope it goes on.
Well, no, the thanks is down to you, because this, look, this is an exercise in public education. People need to know what because people don't have the time to come out and campaign. So it's important that from your own home, you can highlight what are the needs of your family members. Sorry, go on.
Yes, we need society. We need the island of Ireland to come behind us and to support us and to help us. There is no plan. My worst fear is that Leah becomes a 50-year-old orphan, her mom and dad are dead, and her family home is taken from her. What we're asking is for a plan. A plan has to be put in place, not at the very, very end. It's unfair to Leah. As I said, she's got all the same wants and desires, dreams, hopes. She has many gifts and strengths, and she wants to, as I said before, live a life like you and I.
And what kind of a life? Are those gifts? What kind of a life does she want to live? I mean, presumably with as much independence as possible.
Absolutely, and she can only be as independent as the right supports are with her. She attends a day service Monday to Friday. She has work experience and a doggy groomers on a Monday, which she absolutely loves. She goes horse riding. She has a great family, a circle of support. I have incredible neighbours. I'm exceptionally lucky. But I have to work on that. I have to cultivate that. It doesn't come to everybody. And also, Leah's got to be at the heart of all of that. Does this suit Leah? Not what Claire thinks or what the service thinks. What suits Leah? We're so policy rich in this country and implementation poor. You know, we've got many policies of transforming lives, new directions, a time to move on. But the elephant in the room is always down to funding. Leah's life has been subject to funding since the day she was born. And it's terrible. And you've got to beg, steal and borrow. And you've got almost going back to that charitable, to be grateful for what you get. And something needs to radically change.
So when you hear the response that over 2 billion is being spent, how do you take that? Do you take that as a response that's supposed to make you feel grateful in some way?
Yeah, it's either, number one, it's been managed or incorrectly or spent incorrectly, or like that, it's not enough. You know, I know that Leah obviously needs the money for the support, because we're not always going to be around. So it has to be done right, correctly, you know, whether that's brokered, whether people should have a choice.
You talked about the things she likes. You know, she works in the dog groomer. She has, you know, she has that work experience. She does horse riding. She goes to a day service. She knows people. A lot of that is very location specific and who she knows. So it's not any residential service, is it? It's a local residential service.
Without a doubt. And going back to a day service, you're kind of put to a day service with the same people for the rest of your life. So that all needs to be looked at as well, if it's will and preference and choice of people, not just because we're ticking a box that it suits and it becomes an adult babysitting service, which is not what you want. You want her to use her community an ordinary person in an ordinary life in her community, sharing the community. And sometimes I don't think community is ready for our guides because they haven't been supported enough. So there's a lot of work to be done.
And what would Leah need? Is she, you know, would she be happy in you know, a supported environment? Does she have some level of independent activity that she can engage in, or would she require higher support than that?
No, Leah would need obviously some support on her in her day service, which she does get. Leah lives in Black Rock. She goes to the shops. She accesses her community by herself. Leah wants a sense of purpose. She needs a sense of purpose like all of us, you know, that you wake up in the morning and the world is your oyster, and that's what she wants. And it should be like that.
And the supports that you're calling for presumably would be to increase or at least maintain that level of independence so that her needs don't become more acute.
Absolutely. And to do the things, if we're doing circle-centered support, that things that Leah wants to do. So, you know, that Leah is making those choices. There is no respite, unfortunately, in St. John of God's Dublin South East. It was taken up by a person that needed residential. So that's crisis, and that's not what should happen. It should, everybody should be planned. It should, like what your last caller said, that we have a plan in place, that we do maybe respite, and then it turns into residential in a house that Leah lives with the people she wants to live with. Again,
so
like
sorry,
you
the,
and I.
The respite care that had been there and the respite that, is, you know, it has now been used for a full-time residential service due to what? An emergency presentation?
But due to an emergency, yes. We hope to get our respite house back by the end of the year, but that's all down to staffing, etc. But yes, that should never have happened. It should never have happened. If that was properly planned, it wouldn't have happened.
And, you know, Angelina, we heard from Mary there, we heard from Deirdre, a number of other people yesterday as well. I mean, does this fear, this fear about your own mortality affect you on a daily basis as well? And has that been there since the start? When did that begin in your life, if it's there?
Oh, absolutely. You're always thinking of it. And sometimes you might go to a really dark place of maybe Leah might predecease me. And no one wants to live that way. And no one wants to think that way. And it has a massive impact and ripple effect on the rest of the family.
And how do you mean? You think that in some respects, that because of your fear of what might not exist after your time for her, that in her long-term interest, it would be better if she didn't live beyond your time. And I say you only
yes,
have that
absolutely.
As a...
Absolutely, in the back of my head, yes, because the way the system is right now, there is no hope. It's, you know, it's gone beyond crisis. I don't know what to call it. We've almost become desensitized to it, or society mm-hmm. has. I don't know how else to spell it out. We advocate for a lot of families in our area for people that are still living at home who might age 44, 36, 35, and they're living with parents that are aging. And it's really unfair on that person with an intellectual disability to do that. They should be out in the community in a house that they can call their own and living a life just like you and I. And that's not what's happening.
It's a matter of equality, is it? I mean, they're adults over the age of 18. That's, you know...
It's without a doubt, it's discrimination. If you put your name down on the social housing list, you could be down there for years and years, but we need a healthcare package. Leah's not going to live by herself. She needs the support of the state. So it's
and they've put a price on that. It's 149,000 per head for residential care, and you know,
yes,
for personal and home support, it could be, you know, it could be 10,000. There's a variety, but to go to the top of the list, it's, you know, 149,000 on average. Yeah.
But the state have a duty of care. That's not Leah's fault or our guy's fault. You know, this is just the way it is. So it's a duty of care from the state that needs to happen. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Marguerite and Geraldine standing by. We'll hear from them after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
51551 for your text. Joe at rte.ie. You can WhatsApp us 087 184 3709. Cullum O'Mungine here. Marguerite, tell us about Michelle and what kind of a plan you need for her.
Yes, Michelle is Down syndrome and she's 29 years of age, living in Thurles in Tipperary. She attends her residential centre every day, is picked up outside her door and left back in the evening. She's very involved with Special Olympics, or Ormond Special Olympics Club here in Tipperary.
What's her event? What's her chosen sport? Swimming, okay.
Swimming and running 100 metre races, have been involved in All Ireland Special Olympics. And that was a huge achievement for her and a wonderful opportunity for her siblings to see what she can achieve as well. She likes her music, dancing, and she has gone downhill quite a bit, Colm, in the last number of years, not
Why?
Just due to COVID, because her three siblings have left home and she's on her own. And she misses their company, and she talks about them being in their own houses or in their own apartments or whatever. And she would ask about not necessarily what will happen to her when we die, because she's very fearful of speaking about death. Her granny died a number of years ago and that had a huge impact on her. But she would say to me, I don't know would I like to live in residential. And why is she saying that, Colm? Because she doesn't know what it's about. I am lucky, and I suppose I shouldn't even be saying I'm lucky, because it should be part of the state service to her that I get a respite a couple of times a year.
Right, but you feel lucky because not everybody gets it. We heard,
exactly.
You know.
And I'm afraid of my life, Colm, that I'm going to get the phone call and say that she's not going to get it this month because somebody else needs it. And she absolutely loves it. She prepares her bag for it. She prepares her money for it. She plans what they're going to do when they go out. And she comes back a happier adult when she comes back to me.
Do you think she feels that she's on a bit more of a level playing field with the siblings who have left home and has a bit of a life of her own?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I suppose, look at everybody that has spoken for the last 2 days with you are on the same playing pitch. We're all looking for more respite and we're all looking for the plan as to what will happen to our children when we die. And the respite is the first transition that they have to become independent while we're awaiting long-term care. We have set up as a group of parents here in Tipperary. We're aligned to the Down Syndrome Association in Tipperary. And our plan, obviously, is to start working on this. All parents have our adult children. And we see it as a kind of a three-pronged, four-pronged approach.
And what's the age range in those parents you're dealing with?
It would be 18 plus, 18 up to 30, 40. All with elderly parents in their 60s and 70s. And we would see the approach of being three-pronged, four-pronged, that our local county councils have to be involved, aligned with our local health boards, and then we as parents and with our adults. We would see it, and it's what we're going to be looking for, is that when there is a social housing application going in any area in the country, that there should be X amount of houses allocated for respite stroke residential care, and those houses allocated according to the need that are in each area.
So just when you're talking about a four-pronged approach there, the local authority's job is to identify and allocate property to a certain cohort of people with intellectual disabilities. The health board comes in, is it, with the support care that's needed to keep people in those houses?
Yes. Or a specific housing body as well. Here in Thurles area, the Lions Club have a housing body, and they have been very successful in housing people with special needs and other needs. Parents, we have to drive it, and our adults become involved in the decision making as well, and become involved as part of the financial contribution to their keep and to the upkeep of these houses. Why not?
And have you presented any of this, you know, at the local level? To
we have started our process. We have sent in a positional paper to one of our local TDs here in Thurles. We're awaiting come back on that, and we hope to meet with the minister. That's his job will be to meet with Minister Abiet. And I know some of your previous callers have said, you know, call it as a crisis, call it out as a crisis, full stop, end of story. There has been wonderful work done down through the years in terms of the educational system, in terms of integrating special needs children into the educational system. All the adult services, day services are absolutely excellent. The respite that's available is absolutely excellent. Unfortunately, we don't have enough. And if the 2 billion column that's allocated was enough, you'd be doing a different programme today. And the word that I wanted to get out from this programme here today is not to waste any more of our time complaining about this. I'm shouting and calling out to every parent to align themselves with other parents, set up their groups, set up their committees and start working on this as a specific need and a specific area for our adult children going forward.
Now, we've obviously, we did it yesterday, we did it today, we sent in a list of questions to the HSE. I just have the response to hand now, and on the respite issue that you mentioned, which, as you say, in the case of Michelle, would be the dry run for ultimate, you know, independent living. By the way, you mentioned that you had a bereavement in the family. Her grandmother died. I mean, how did she cope with the grief? I mean,
Michelle,
is that something that...
How did we cope with it? Obviously, she knew she was dying. She visited her in the hospital. She was there just the day or two before she died. Her granny lived just across the way from her, and her granny reared her while I was not around, out working.
Right. And it was a big loss for the whole family. Commiserations
huge
loss, on
an
that.
Absolute huge. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's a couple of years ago, but she had a delayed reaction to it. And then one by one, her other three siblings left home. And as each of them left, you could see her just going downhill. And the minute, Colm, one of them rings her or walks in here, her persona changes. She knows she's at home on her own. And her sisters would ring her and ask her, how did she get on in respite? Oh, she said it was brilliant. It was great to get a break from the two of them, her father and her mother, and how right she is.
Right, I suppose, yeah. Everybody knows the feeling, but, you know, it's the distance that makes everybody able to cope with the closeness afterwards. The HSE says about respite, they says the HSE is very much aware of the importance of respite service provision. They say it's a key priority for the HSE for people with disabilities and their families, and they've seen significant investment in respite services in the last few years, and they continue to work with agencies to explore various ways of responding to this need in line with the budget available.
I know. But look, it's a problem. Haven't we a crisis everywhere? And if we grasp it bit by bit, I'm sure Minister Abiet is as overwhelmed with her workload as we as parents are overwhelmed with the worry of what's going to happen to our adult children. But if we can sit down in parent groups aligned to specific disability organisations, together, of course we can grasp the nettle, and of course we can start bit by bit over the next 5 to 10 years.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely, and we have to do that, and that's where my energy is going to go to.
Right.
There's no point in us, you know, blaming or wasting time or complaining. Get out there, and we must do it together.
Geraldine Foy, we've heard stories from, you know, Angelina was talking about her son Edward.
Yes.
We've heard Marguerite talking about Michelle. In your case,
I'm looking after my brother-in-law Tony for the past 30 years. Because his parents got old and his father died recently. So we took Tony over to give him a better life living with us, because what didn't come across your programme is sometimes Tony wouldn't be able to tell me he has a pain or he's unwell. I'd have to see it. I'd have to watch him. And then I'd ring the GP. And that's why when Finny McGrath was the Minister for Disabilities, he was trying to get some of these homes set up for disabled people to move into when they got on in years. So all these factors would come into play, and the care would be around the person as opposed to the person trying to fit into the HSE's care programme at the moment. But the respite problem in Ireland is set up by the HSE to deny respite to people because they have two forms for respite. I don't want to rain on anybody's parade that was listening in, but I've had a screaming match with the HSE, Stephen Donnelly, and Mary Butler wrote to me today. The first form is, if you're under 65, you can have respite for under 65. But if in our case you're over 65 and you don't have anything like Alzheimer's, dementia, or one of those ageing conditions, the form says you can't take that box, you can't fill in the form and complete the form. Right?
So sorry, there's one respite form up to the age of 65.
That's the one form, yes.
Right, so at some point, according to that form, an adult retires from having an intellectual disability and transforms. Is that the logic
exactly.
of that?
Exactly. The system, as I wrote to Stephen Donnelly last week, I said to Stephen Donnelly, and these are the exact words in the email, in my 30 years caring for my brother-in-law on a day-to-day basis, the system and the services have disinterested itself to influence us with an objective decision to deny services. That's how the HSE has set this up. The barriers for caring for somebody full-time, it's tiring, it's exhausting. But in my case, there's two other adults living with me. I can walk out the door and leave them here with them, right? I went off to buy in pyjamas 2 weeks ago. The other fella went down to the bathroom. He got out the door and we had to pick him up off the road. It's tricky. But the system does not suit...
But he heads off from the house if he's not supervised. Is it? This is your brother-in-law.
Well, he'll come off looking for me.
All right.
Exactly.
And what age is he? He's over 65. What age is he?
75 now.
Is he in good nick? Well, he's obviously mobile if he can get out of the house and follow you down the road.
He's in great nick. He wouldn't be able to make food for himself or wash himself, but he is in great nick. He would hold the conversation joke, would you? But at the same time, if he had a pain, he wouldn't be able to tell he had a pain.
And how come?
Because an intellectual problem. There's an intellectual problem with the brain to a certain age.
Right, he finds it hard to communicate discomfort or sickness.
Yeah, he's a child in a man's body. So when he was with the doctor with this bad chest infection, the GP said to him, Tony, have you got a cold? No, nothing wrong with me. But he's sitting there and he ended up on antibiotics. That's why I think these units are very important to observe the symptoms in the person that can't tell you. Because he won't tell you he has a pain. He can't. He doesn't. He's not aware of it, right?
And you wrote to the health minister, and you wrote for the minister with responsibility for disabilities. Now I haven't seen your correspondence. Did you get a reply?
I got two replies from them, and I wrote to the CEO Bernard Goslin.
Bernard Gloucester of the HSE. Who say, by the way, that they're very sorry to hear parents and their children are having experiences shared on this programme.
Should be put on the wall and throw darts at it and rotten eggs. Because that's its value from my experience. I don't mean to degrade the HSE. They do other good things. But vulnerable disabled people are totally forgotten about in Ireland. The services have gone downhill since 2008. They've never been replaced. But I wrote to Bernard Goslin, CEO, and I told him, you went into an Oireachtas-style committee on health on March 22nd, and you said the buck stops with this for you. You're responsible for those two forms. You're responsible for people not being able to get respite services. And not everybody that's 75 has a degenerative brain condition. And for any parent out there, write to the info, CEO Bernard Goslin, the whole lot of you, and tell him about the respite services. And do it on a monthly or yearly basis, because that way you will get the attention you're crying for on the airways.
All right, and as I say, they issued us with a response, which you probably heard me read out.
Their money budget is too small. If somebody's in a court
62 million by the last...
Hold on. Look at it this way. Look at the monetary value in the court cases. If somebody's in a court case that the HSE done damage to, they're walking out the door with millions. for the life needs of that person, their child. But the HSE is paying the money. The point I'm making is, Ireland have left these people behind once again. Since the physical apocalypse hit this country in 2008,
you're pointing to the fact that when the state claims agencies make settlements with people, they calculate what their life needs would be if they have physical needs. So they're capable of putting a price on it.
My point is, they know the money that they're talking about today is too small. And that's the point.
Alison Whitty, tell us about your son.
My son is 20, and just listening to the other callers, maybe coming from a different angle whereby he doesn't need respite, but he is autistic. He was diagnosed when he was 3.5. And I suppose I wanted to lend my voice with the other callers just to talk about the broken service that we have, that once you know that there's an issue with your child, you're pinned to your collar, and you're fighting from day one. That's it. Even listening to others yesterday, what I felt all along is that you're just fighting and fighting, and certainly education and fight and support and fight shouldn't be in the same sentence. I suppose we're slightly different in the sense that I wouldn't be looking for respite care for him. He hopefully will be going to third level in September, but he needs an awful lot of other support along. He would have, emotional and behavioural issues and communication issues. And the amount of research, the amount of work that I have had to do and the amount of work that he has had to do over the years has been phenomenal. I mean, I'm sure there's so many parents out there that are listening today that feel the same way as me.
And he's a young man. He's 20 years of age.
He's a young man,
and you sound like a young woman yourself. So,
well, I'm not that young anymore. Well,
I'm not going to ask your age, but I'm just saying, judging by the sound of your voice, and maybe that's presumptuous on my part.
Yeah.
But, we began yesterday, talking about with Angelina and her concerns for what happens after her time and the need for a plan. I mean, is that something that has worried you as well?
Absolutely. There is no plan. He is my only child, and that's a huge consideration for me. There is no plan. And I think I've always felt that what happens is nobody will meet you halfway, and it's an open secret. It's an open secret that this doesn't work. And I have gone through some recent difficulties that I'm not going to discuss, but I've been in battle. I've had to ask, as I am, who have been they're an amazing charity for advocacy work. And I think we've come to some light at the end of the tunnel, but it took a really serious situation in my home to move me, and to I've had basically no help. You have to do this on your own, is what I'm trying to say. And the support services that should be meeting us halfway aren't. So
I wholly appreciate that. You don't want to get into the details of it, but it took a significant event, a crisis.
Yes, absolutely. And you don't have any help, and people aren't telling you the full story. So what you have to do, I mean, the support services aren't, out there, aren't giving you the full story, and you have to go away and do a huge. I've done a huge body of work since really slightly before Christmas to get us into this position with the help of As I Am. I've contacted my local TDs, and this is not the first time I've done that. You're doing with trying to get SNA support. The schools are pinned to their collars as well. So going forward, you go from your primary school, you've battled through that. You're going through secondary school.
How much of your time does this take up?
All of it. I gave up my career to be his carer. That's it. You're a mum first and foremost, but you're also an advocate, a carer, a therapist. You're all of that. And if to do the job well, you have no option, Colm.
And there still aren't enough hours in the day, judging by what you're saying.
No, 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 and you can't, you don't have the luxury of enjoying your child because you're always afraid of what's to come. And now I'm starting off from scratch again because we've, the school, both schools that he has gone to have been amazing. The support from the people within the schools are amazing. But the fight to get support, it's too much at times, right, Colm. And I'm sure there are many parents who will tell you the
same
indeed, thing.
And I'm going to bring you some more of what the HSE has to say. We're also going to hear from Leonora Lane after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here, 51551 for your text. Joe at rte.ie by email, WhatsApp 087 184 3709. I want to return to that statement we got from the HSE in response to a number of queries. And in that statement, it said the HSE acknowledges the demographic challenges, that's changes in the population, associated with the increase of the number of people living with disability and an increase in age and life expectancy, have all led to the need for increased residential facilities, and that's what we're looking at today. People who are wondering about residential care after their time has passed and their children need some form of residential support, whether that be independent supported living or higher support needs. But it's what's interesting in this statement, it says a significant underlying challenge relates to the latent unmet need for residential and respite care which exists in our services as a result of the absence of a multi-annual investment during the economic downturn. So in other words, a long-term budget to fund this area, the HSE acknowledges itself that this is a problem. And as a result of this, the statement says, we are now experiencing a high annual demand for emergency residential places to respond to the most urgent cases on our list. And later in the statement, it says they are using respite beds due to the presenting complexity of the individual. In other words, people with high support needs are presenting to what were respite facilities and they're being used for longer term residential care, which is in turn bringing down the number of respite beds, which they say has overall increased, but brought down the number of respite beds as a result of the underinvestment post-crash. Leonora Lane, thanks for joining us and good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. Thank you very much. I have a little boy. I'm speaking from the other side of things. I have a little boy, David. He's five. He's the most beautiful little boy. And he was diagnosed just before he was two with autism. He is nonverbal and he has moderate intellectual disabilities. What I find most difficult, and I speak with a lot of the community and speak on their behalf, is that every single thing is a fight to get speech therapist, to get an occupation therapist. The school placement, I'm after going through 6 months of fight of reports to get my son the most appropriate school placement for next September.
Just explain the reports. What did you have to provide by way of documentation, assessments, etc. to get that school place?
Firstly, he's suited to a special school, and where he presently is a unit. Units are fantastic for children that are able for it. My little man isn't. So he was causing a lot of disruption inside in the class before Christmas especially. He wasn't able, they weren't able to meet his needs. They didn't have the sensory room. They didn't have, not the school's fault, it's the system's fault. So then I got in contact with St. Clair's in Innes, and the principal there, he was absolutely heartwarming to me. And he said, get your reports saying, you know, which was happening. He was regressing. He was getting more agitated. He was waking through the night because of the stress of the school environment was not appropriate to him. So at least after 6-8 months of fighting, I've eventually got the appropriate school place for him in September. But my point is, everything is a fight. You have the heartache of having a child that doesn't celebrate birthdays, that doesn't celebrate Christmas. And then you have, then on the other side, the services that you have to fight and be their advocate. And that alone is draining. That alone is just breaking. It's a breaking for, like, a lot of families, you know, that it shouldn't be for the most vulnerable children of Ireland that we have to fight. I just don't think it's fair.
And you, as you say, you're at the beginning of the road on this, although your little boy is 5 years old. So I'm sure it doesn't feel like the beginning of a road, given the effort you've put into it. It sounds like it's been a long road so far.
It has, it has. Like, he was diagnosed when he was 2, and it's just like he goes 14 hours a day and trying to get the help. Like, you know, everything now is private. His speech therapist is private. His occupation therapist is private because the public system is buckled, absolutely buckled. And as much as I have asked and emailed and rang and, you know, asked for everything, like, you know, you don't get it from the public system. Everything now is private.
And could you put a figure on what it's cost to get all those private services at this early stage, at 5 years of age? You got a diagnosis 3 years ago. Have you any idea private. How much you've spent on the private services you've had to access so far?
I would say, like, his assessment alone was 2,000, and weekly OT is 75 when I was doing it, and his speech therapist 90. I'd say to date, I'm getting reports, letters of support trying to get him to the appropriate school placements. They don't come cheap. So I suppose to date I would.
How do you mean they don't come cheap? You have to go to a specialist. Is it a child psychologist to get those letters of support?
No, what I had to do is I had to ask his private occupation therapist to do a report, and I also had to ask his private speech therapist to do a report, you know, just saying where he is at school at the moment, and to pay for them to go into the school as well to see the setting to be able to do the report.
And how much does a report cost per report?
Anything up to 250.
And then you say that, so the specialist has to go into the school in order to write up how that would suit your son's needs, is it?
Yeah.
How much does that cost?
That's
part of the report, is it?
The speech therapist went in and the occupation therapist has spoken with them and has gone in, and they did the reports for me, just saying that where he is, he's regressing, he's not able for it, and they don't have the appropriate setting to meet his needs. So that all, everything has cost money. Everything with autism is money. Even the toys he plays with, they're mostly sensory, and that is double the price of a normal toy that you walk into Smith's to buy.
So when you heard, you know, from Angelina yesterday, or from Marguerite or Mary or Geraldine or Alison today, talking about the situations they're in, you know, you're into this journey 3 years. Their children are 36, you know, 75 for Geraldine's brother-in-law. Yeah. When you look down the barrel of that and the fight you're talking about putting in, what does that look like?
Despair. The future. I hope, and it's something that has been said to me, look, it's a way off and times will change. I hope so, but it shouldn't have to come to that. It should be changed right now for the most vulnerable kids and adults in Ireland.
But at the moment, I mean, day to day, it strikes me that you don't really have the ability to look down the line that far. What you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis is already taking up an awful lot of your time. But, I mean, even on the level of what we started with Angelina yesterday, I mean, do you have those worries about after your time? Have they started this early in the life of your little boy?
Absolutely. Of course. It's every day. What happens if something happens to me tomorrow? Who minds David? Do you know, that's exactly, it's a constant worry, and it's a worry for every single parent of a child with a disability. It's a constant worry. It's a worry all the time, the future. But as another wise mum said to me, a friend of mine, she said, live in the day, don't think about tomorrow. And that has helped me enormously. I just deal with today, and tomorrow is tomorrow. Because if you think down the line, I don't think, you know, I think it makes your day much, much harder.
Okay, well, we have more parents standing by. We're going to hear from PJ, Drudy and Barbara after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungoyne here, 51551 for your texts, joe@rte.ie for the emails or WhatsApp us, 087-184-3709. PJ, Drudy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin, and thank you very much indeed for dealing with this. It's a very, very serious issue, and as one lady said earlier, a tsunami is about to hit the government on this issue. I've been hearing heartbreaking stories from the parents, all sorts of fantastic, amazing stories and amazing people, but also heartbreaking in relation to people with intellectual disabilities themselves, whose rights are denied, trampled on for years, consistently ignored for years by successive governments. They were called the neglected citizens of Ireland as far as back in 1996 in the report on the Commission on Disabilities. So, I mean, this is a huge issue which cannot be ignored any further. It's been ignored for far too long.
People might recognise your name. You're a former professor of economics at Trinity College, and you know were a kind of vocal, or at least appeared regularly in the media in that capacity. But you're also a parent. Your 36-year-old son has Down syndrome and autism.
Yes, indeed, Colm. 36 years of age and Down syndrome and autism. He's one of four children. Now, I should say that he was on the housing list for many years. And eventually we were offered a place. And let me tell you what age I was when he was offered a place, because it may be of some interest. I was 75 years of age 5 years ago when David was offered a place. And I would hope that no parent waits that long for a place.
And when did he first go on the housing? I mean, how long were you waiting for that offer?
I'd say he was 20 years on the housing list. And there are others who are perhaps 30 years on the housing list. So, I mean, it's an appalling situation. You have to be on the housing list to be actually considered at all, because effectively, what we're talking about is social housing for people with intellectual disabilities or other disabilities, of course. I should also say that we were offered the place when a man died. That is how bad it is, Colm. There was no funding available.
So David needed somebody to die for him to get a place, a residential place.
Somebody had to die. It's as simple as that. Take Dublin South East as an example. Dublin South East did not get a single funded place over the period 2006 to 2022. We got four people funded in 2022 for the first time in 16 years. How on earth can that be tolerated? So really, but we are the lucky ones, Colm. Even though I was 75, we were the lucky ones, because there are thousands of families out there in despair. And I was listening. It's absolutely heartbreaking to listen. We have an immediate list in St. John of God's four areas. We have Kerry, the South East, Dublin South East, North East and Kildare. We have an immediate, and we're talking about immediate, waiting list of 623 people. So therefore, we need at least 300 homes immediately. Not in 10 years' time, not in 5 years' time. So as one of your callers said earlier, our people with disabilities want to live normal lives like everybody else.
Now tell us about your own son. What kind of a character is he, and what does he want?
Well, our son has always been challenging. Autistic people generally are challenging. And what he wants is a normal life. And he's in fairness to him and to the St. John of God Brothers and to St. John of God Community Services, they are indeed trying their utmost to give him a normal life with staff and meeting with his friends and going on outings and so on. So there's no doubt about it that residential is absolutely central to providing the parents, all these parents who ring you now, with the sort of comfort they need in their old age and before they die. Because otherwise people would say, I'd prefer he or she would die before I die.
And that's something you've heard before, because we've heard it, you know, we heard it earlier this afternoon, that, you know, this is what some parents have to contemplate in their heads.
There's no doubt about that, Colm. People are saying, I wish to God, I hope to God, he will die, or she will die before I do, because they're terrified, literally terrified. I know people who are virtually suicidal. I meet parents day in, day out. And as chairman of the Housing Association, we're desperate to provide homes for them. And yet, we have all sorts of blockages. In particular, we have the blockage of lack of funding for staffing. That is an absolutely central issue.
All right. You've a lifelong experience in crunching numbers and that. The HSE statement said that the respite funding has grown from, in 2018, from 53 million up to 96 million. The overall budget is in excess of 2 billion, and residential services take up 60% of that. Of that budget, in excess of, I think, 1.2 billion. I mean, what do you make of those numbers?
Well, I'm sure those numbers are correct. They cover all forms of disability, possibly, and they possibly cover old age, and they probably cover a whole range. Intellectual disability is the one that has been seriously neglected. I would say that a relatively small sum has been allocated. Let me tell you about the disability capacity review carried out by the Department of Health in 2021. It recommended an additional 400 million for staffing of homes in 2022 alone. Of course, no money was provided. And Isha recommended
just to make sure we're singing off the same hymn sheet there was a disability capacity review up to 2032. This is the same one that says in order to meet residential care needs, up to 800 million additional would need to be spent. An extra billion might need to be spent above the 2018 level by 2032.
Correct. You've got it dead right, Colm. Well done. I mean, certainly there are issues other than housing, obviously, but housing was the big one. Residential was 400 million, and the total, I think, was 600 million in 2022, rising, as you said, to a total of 800 million or 800 million in 2027 and on to the billion.
But to take it back to the personal, PJ, because that's the funding that would provide a residential place for a person to go into and to give parents those that peace of mind they are looking for. So talk us through the difference. At age 75, after 20 years of your son being on the social housing list, the difference it made to you the day you heard that he had got that place and the ability for, is it a local residential place?
Oh, it is a local within a few miles of our home. It was fine. It was great.
Tell us the impact that was, both for him and for you. Give us an insight into what that means if that money is provided to people to provide that residential place.
Well, the impact is enormous because, of course, we had him for 31 years, effectively, on our own, and we were both trying to hold down jobs, and our children were helping us out, and so on and so on and so on. But I mean, David is challenging. He's autistic. He's not just easy going. He's very demanding, and was very demanding for 31 years. And my wife was an absolute jewel in this matter. She's a rock. And
you didn't know he was autistic for all of that time, am I right in saying?
No, we didn't. We only got the diagnosis about, I think, 10 years ago. It was very late in the day.
So for 20 of those 31 years you had him at home, you didn't have supports that were autism-specific provided?
No, and even today, the supports for autistic children are quite small, and staff who are dealing with autism need specific training, Colm. That's an absolutely central issue, the whole training of staff for people with autism. But I mean, it has made a huge impact on our lives in a way, because he comes home on the weekends now, and that's fine. But he goes back and he wants to go back to the home because he's happy. He has independence of his own. He has a life of his own, as every person with a disability want. They want, as somebody said earlier in your program, they want normal lives like everybody else. But Colm, they have an entitlement. They have rights. And I think the government has signed up to the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. It's signed and ratified that convention. It's legally binding. Now, the question is this: why are they not implementing it via the capacity review, which is telling them all about the funding that is required?
Because I just want to ask you, PJ, in the time we have remaining, if you can give it to us in about a minute, you've been out in previous years in your career as a professor of economics in Trinity College Dublin around budget time. That discussion has begun already. We've heard the figure of 1.5 billion being put on a tax break. We hear about 13 billion in an escrow account, 16 billion of a surplus potentially next year, 10 billion of a surplus this year. And, you know, that money can't be blown on, you know, year to year funding. And what argument would you make as a professor of economics for this sector being funded and having a call on some of that money?
Well, the question is, do you want people to have huge health issues down the parents to have huge health issues, or their children, their ID children to have huge? There could be huge costs associated with doing nothing. And really, when we talk about tax breaks, for goodness sake, tax breaks of 1.5 billion, that would go a huge distance towards solving the problem of people with intellectual disabilities. So as an economist, I get seriously angry when I hear the way that the funding is thrown about the place as if it were confetti. Really, people, these are human beings with rights. The Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is a key document that the government needs to implement tomorrow morning. Remember, Colm, we're talking here about social housing for people with disabilities. We, in a housing association such as mine or ours, we are doing the work of the government.
And there are carers all over the country who are taking up that. I'm afraid that's
correct.
We're going to have to give you the last word, PJ Drudy. That's points well made, and we're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.